Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 264. It's Monday, July 8th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, let's get started up with a local story. This from the Toledo Lucas County Health Department. Health Department and City of Toledo announce Healthy Corner Store Initiative. The Toledo Lucas County Health Department, in collaboration with the City of Toledo, are pleased to announce a new initiative aimed at increasing the availability and awareness of nutrition, food, and beverage options in neighborhood corner stores in underserved communities. The Healthy Corner Store Initiative will work to respond to food access disparities observed in lower-income communities. The initiative prioritizes food deserts and is encouraging interested small stores to apply, particularly if they serve residents receiving WIC or SNAP benefits. Through the end of next year, or through December 31st, 2026, selected stores may be awarded up to $20,000 for items such as refrigeration and freezers to help with stocking fresh food items, as well as educational opportunities for store owners. The Healthy Food Small Market Program has three primary objectives. Enhancing healthy food accessibility. The primary goal of the initiative is to improve access to nutritious foods such as fresh fruits and vegetables by bolstering the infrastructural capabilities of corner stores with essential resources like refrigeration and freezers to facilitate the effective stocking of healthy products. Empowerment through training and technical assistance. Store owners will receive comprehensive training and technical support to increase the retail availability and profitability of offering healthier dietary choices. Fostering community partnerships. By forging robust connections between store owners, local agriculturalists, and fresh food suppliers, along with private and public partnerships, all working to improve food accessibility. Way to go. Nice to see this program that's addressing an important need in our community. Okay, well, next up, let's turn to the single largest preventable cause of death. That would be tobacco use. This from the World Health Organization. The World Health Organization releases first-ever clinical treatment guideline for tobacco cessation in adults. The World Health Organization recommends a comprehensive set of tobacco cessation interventions, including behavioral support delivered by healthcare providers, digital cessation interventions, and pharmacological treatments in a first guideline on tobacco cessation. The guideline focuses on helping the more than 750 million tobacco users worldwide who want to quit all forms of tobacco. The recommendations are relevant for all adults seeking to quit various tobacco products, including cigarettes, water pipes, smokeless tobacco products, cigars, roll-your-own tobacco, and heated tobacco products, which are often termed vapes. Over 60% of the world's 1.25 billion tobacco users, more than 750 million people wish to quit, yet 70% lack access to effective cessation services. This gap exists due to challenges faced by health systems, including resource limitations. Combining pharmacotherapy with behavioral interventions significantly increases quitting success rates. Countries are encouraged to provide these treatments at no or reduced cost to improve accessibility, particularly in low and middle income countries. And of course, here in the States, you can call the Tobacco Quit Line to get counseling, resources, and referrals by calling 1-800-QUIT-NOW. That's 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Okay, well, next up we have a story about a much less understood and appreciated public health problem. That would be noise pollution. This from UnDark. Advocates sue EPA to enforce noise pollution law. Last June, an anti-noise advocacy group, Quiet Community, sued the Environmental Protection Agency for not doing its job to limit the loud sounds people are exposed to in everyday life. The group is now waiting to hear if it will be able to argue its case in front of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. If the judge ultimately rules in the group's favor, the EPA will have to do what Congress told it to do more than a half a century ago, when it passed the Noise Control Act to protect public health and the environment from harmful noise pollution. The federal effort to control noise started out well. After the noise legislation was passed in 1972, the EPA set up the Office of Noise Abatement and Control, which quickly got to work studying noise and promulgating regulations, including one to limit noise from garbage trucks. That was later rescinded. Super loud noise was already well known to damage ears and even cause deafness. Studies showing harmful effects like heart disease and learning disorders were just beginning to accumulate. The office was on track to consider jackhammers, lawnmowers, air conditioners, bulldozers, vacuum cleaners, and chainsaws, with an eye toward setting noise limits. A major piece of the program was the education of the public. "We would have avoided a lot of damage," said Charles Elkins, who headed the office from 1975 to 1981. "Today, if you live within earshot of an interstate highway, if your child's school sits next to train tracks, or if your neighbor is out there wielding a gas-powered leaf blower, you're mostly out of luck." The Ronald Reagan administration began the process of defunding Elkins' office in 1981, saying local communities rather than the federal government should regulate environmental noise. Elkins describes this reasoning as, quote, "a fake." The office remains defunded to this day. Decibel levels and exposure times for the amount of noise that physically damage the ears is well known. Several researchers looking at the health effects of chronic exposure to lower levels of noise have told me it's hard to find funding for their work. Nevertheless, there have been some impressive findings. In a recently published review, European researchers concluded that noise from transportation increases the risk of heart disease, heart failure, and stroke. Such disease is also known to raise the levels of stress hormones, disturb sleep, and stress the blood vessels, which the teams hypothesized could explain their findings. Other studies have linked noise to an increase in the risk of diabetes. So there you go. This anti-noise advocacy group, Quiet Communities, get their case heard, and we actually get this over a half century's law enforced. Okay, well, next up, we got a safety story that has an Ohio connection. This from the Environmental Health Network. Rail industry opposes faster removal of unsafe tank cars. Federal investigators are pushing to speed up the removal of puncture-prone DOT 111 tank cars from trains, facing strong opposition from the rail and chemical industries. The 2013 Lac Megantic disaster, which caused the death of 47 people in Canada, renewed calls to phase out DOT 111 tank cars due to their safety risks. However, over 25,000 of these cars are still in use, with complete phase out not expected until 2029. Industry opposition and cost concerns hinder the acceleration of their removal, despite repeated warnings to do so by the National Transportation Safety Board. "We shouldn't wait until 2029 to phase these out. We have recommendations we've issued since 1991 stating that they should no longer be in service," said the chair of the National Transportation Safety Board. Why this matters? These DOT 111 tank cars have been involved in numerous fatal derailments, posing ongoing risks. In fact, the East Palestine disaster last year in Ohio was initiated when three DOT 111 cars with flammable materials ruptured and started a fire after the derailment that led to the vent and burn of five vinyl chloride tank cars, investigators found. Delays in phasing them out could lead to more preventable disasters, threatening communities and the environment. Hardly news that an industry is resisting saving money at the expense of public health. Okay, well, next up, we got a story about the damage wrought by the chemical industry. This from The Guardian. Coffee, eggs, and white rice linked to higher levels of PFAS in human body. New research aimed at identifying foods that contain higher levels of PFAS found people who eat more white rice, coffee, eggs, and seafood typically show more of the toxic chemicals in their plasma and breast milk. The study checked samples from 3,000 pregnant mothers and is among the first research to suggest coffee and white rice may be contaminated at higher rates than other foods. It also identified an association between red meat consumption and levels of PFAS, one of the most common and dangerous PFAS compounds. The author said the findings highlight the chemical's ubiquity and the many ways they can end up in the food supply. The results definitely point toward the need for environmental stewardship and keeping PFAS out of the environment and food chain, said Megan Romano, a Dartmouth researcher and lead author. Now we're in a situation where they're everywhere and are going to stick around even if we do aggressive remediation. PFAS are a class of about 16,000 compounds used to make products that resist water, stains, and heat. They are called forever chemicals because they do not naturally break down and have been found to accumulate in humans. The chemicals are linked to cancer, birth defects, liver disease, thyroid disease, plummeting sperm counts, and a range of other serious health problems. Though regulators have focused on reining in pollution in water, food is thought to be the most common exposure route. The Food and Drug Administration, however, has drawn criticism for what some say is a failure to protect the nation's food supply. Among other controversies, it altered its testing methods to make it appear as if the food it tests does not have PFAS in it, when it actually does contain what many advocates say are concerning levels. PFAS can end up contaminating food through a number of routes. In rice, the researchers suspect it stems from contaminated soil or agricultural water. Nonstick cookware also often contains a chemical, or it could be in the water used for cooking. Researchers found higher levels of PFAS associated with eggs from backyard chickens, which Romano said could be attributed to the birds more commonly being fed with table scraps. PFAS fouled sewage sludge, which is used as a cheap alternative fertilizer, may also contaminate the soil from which chickens feed and has been found to contaminate beef. The chemical also could be in the birds' feed. In coffee, researchers suspect that the beans, water used for brewing, or soil could be contaminated. Previous researchers also found coffee filters to be treated with PFAS, and paper cups or other food packaging also commonly contain the chemicals. Seafood, meanwhile, has regularly been found to be contaminated with PFAS because water pollution is so widespread. Public health advocates say a ban on the chemicals, except for essential uses, is the only way to begin addressing the problem broadly. Romano said the research found diets high in fruit, whole grain, and higher dietary fiber were associated with lower levels of some PFAS, and eating a varied diet so no one protein source comprises too large of a proportion of intake is beneficial. That helps you not only reduce your exposure to PFAS, but other contaminants you might anticipate are in foods, Romano said. So, of course, that last comment is just the fact that by eating less processed foods, you're less to get PFAS. Another roundabout endorsement of a whole foods plant-based diet.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever. Callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, next up, I have a truly fascinating story on the carbon emissions from transportation. This from phys.org, that's phys.org. The true scale of carbon impact from long-distance travel revealed. The reality of the climate impact of long-distance passenger travel has been revealed in new research from the University of Leeds. Despite only accounting for less than 3% of all trips by UK residents, journeys of more than 50 miles one way are responsible for 70% of all passenger travel-related carbon emissions. The disparity is even greater when international travel is singled out. International journeys are only 0.4% of total trips, but are responsible for 55% of emissions. The new research published in the journal Nature Energy also shows that targeting long-distance travel may be a more effective way of tackling emissions than current efforts focusing on local and commuter journeys. While the number of long and short distance domestic journeys by car has fallen slightly over the last 25 years, international air travel has increased significantly, driven by an increase in trips for leisure and visiting friends and family. Dr. Zia Wadud from the University Institute for Transport Studies and School of Chemical and Process Engineering, who led the research, said, "The scale of the impact of long-distance travel is very large indeed. That just less than 3% of our trips is responsible for around 60% of miles and 70% of emissions shows how important long-distance travel is in the fight to combat climate change. Worryingly, long-distance trips, especially flights, have been growing." So, I wanted to dig into this. I went to the actual article, and they have a great little chart showing all these different options. The one I found most interesting was that if UK residents were to take only one or less international round trip per year, that would reduce the total UK emissions by 34% for transportation. That would affect one in 500 trips that people take. So that 0.2% of trips could affect over a third of the transportation emissions. Wow. And to show that that's in a little bit of a different way, if you were to take all UK international holidays and switch them to a 300-mile one-way by car, that would reduce UK transportation emissions by about 28%. Yes, it makes a difference, the choices we make. And apparently long travel, particularly air travel, is a big part of transportation emissions. Now, of course, the details of this is going to vary by country, but this is really a landmark study. Okay, well, for those of us who walk and bike as our primary way of getting around, this is a good story from Medical Express. U.S. pedestrian deaths declined for first time since pandemic. For the first time since the pandemic, it got a little safer to cross America's streets in 2023, new statistics show. According to data released from the Governor's Highway Safety Association, 7,318 American pedestrians were killed by motor vehicles last year, a dip of 5.4% from 2022, and the first such decline since the pandemic ended. But it's no time for celebration. The 2023 number of pedestrian deaths is still 14% above pre-pandemic levels. The report also gave insights into how and where pedestrians are most often killed. You're far more likely to be hit by a car at night, accounting for 78% of pedestrian deaths in 2022, rather than the daytime. And nighttime fatal pedestrian crashes nearly doubled from 3,030 in 2010 to almost 5,800 in 2022. That's a much steeper rise than what happened for deaths occurring during the day. Sidewalks are crucial. In 2022, 66% of pedestrian deaths occurred in locales without sidewalks. Sidewalks can help protect people walking by providing a physical separation between them and motor vehicle traffic. But they are missing or in poor condition in many parts of the country. 3/4 of pedestrian deaths in 2022 were not at an intersection. Alcohol is too often a factor as well. In 2022, 30% of pedestrians 16 and older killed in motor vehicle crashes had a blood alcohol concentration of 0.08 or higher. That was also true for 19% of drivers who killed a pedestrian. So it's both the pedestrians that have high blood alcohol levels and the drivers. Okay, well, let's switch gears a bit and do a couple stories on LGBTQ folks. This from Medical Express. Rates of distress, depression have doubled among transgender Americans since 2014. The rate of self-reported mental distress and depression among American adults who identify as transgender or gender diverse has more than doubled between 2014 and 2022, an analysis of federal health data reveals. The findings are published in the journal JAMA Internal Medicine. The prevalence of frequent mental distress increased from 19% in 2014 to 39% in 2022, among transgender or gender-diverse people. In contrast, the rise in mental distress was less steep among cisgender people, from 11% to 16%. Depression rates among transgender and gender-diverse adults also rose sharply between 2014 and 2022, more than doubling from 20% to 51%. Over the same time period, depression rates among cisgender adults rose only slightly, from 19% to 21%. Even physical health was affected. During the study period, the percentage of transgender and gender-diverse adults who rated their health as just fair or poor went from 27% to 35%, while that number remains stable at just over 17% among cisgender people. And next up, focusing specifically on LGBTQ youth, this from USA Today. LGBTQ youth crisis line launched in 2023. It's been swamped. A 988 crisis lifeline for LGBTQ youths launched a year ago. It's been swamped. The numbers are staggering. 39% of young people who identify as LGBTQ plus seriously considered attempting suicide within the last year. The data from a May 2024 study by the Trevor Project, a crisis intervention nonprofit for LGBTQ plus youth, also shows that more than 1 in 10, or 12%, actually attempted suicide. For transgender and non-binary young people, it's even worse. 46% report having considered suicide within the last year. And only half of those who wanted mental health care were able to access it. The 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, which went national in 2022, launched a sub-network in 2023 for LGBTQ plus young people, aimed at closing the gap in care for a vulnerable population and offering specialized care. And after nearly a year, the sub-network is making an impact, its data shows. From July 3, 2023 to May 3, 2024, the 988 LGBTQI plus sub-network received about 480,000 calls, online chats, and texts. The sub-network saw a 12% month-over-month increase from its July 2023 launch to April 2024. Young people can access crisis counselors trained in LGBTQ plus issues by dialing 988 and then pressing 3, or by texting PRIDE to 988. Calls alone increased by 67% from July 23 to April 2024, according to Vibrant Emotional Health, which works with the National Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration to administer the helpline. The need for specialized care for LGBTQ plus people. There are unique challenges around stigma and persecution and lack of acceptance for LGBTQ young people, said Adam Callahan, Director of Cross-Functional Planning for Vibrant Emotional Health. So one real reason to build the sub-network is to give members of this community the safety of connecting with someone who understands what they're experiencing, someone who won't judge them. If they're still closeted in particular, you want someone who gets it and who starts with a baseline knowledge, he said. LGBTQ plus people, especially those who are transgender or gender diverse, experience mistreatment in healthcare and behavioral health settings at alarming rates. Having a helpline that is intentionally affirming provides a layer of security for individuals in crisis, that they are less likely to experience an additional layer of ignorance or mistreatment during an already vulnerable or even life-threatening time. As some states enact or propose legislation targeting transgender rights, the pushback against transgender identity and the transgender experience have really impacted folks. Book bans, censorship of materials related to the LGBTQ plus experience, and curbs on how educators can address LGBTQ plus issues with students all have a huge impact on people, especially in rural communities, said Callahan, who grew up in rural Missouri. The implementation of a dedicated system of mental health care for LGBTQ plus people funded by the federal government is a clear and direct sign there is care and concern around the needs of this community, a community that historically had to fight not just recognition and respect, but also for equity in health care. It's a very important statement, and it's not just the message, it's the messenger. Okay, and to repeat that line, if people want to access it, young people can access crisis counselors trained in LGBTQ plus issues by dialing 988 and then pressing 3, or by texting PRIDE to 988. Again, that's by dialing 988 and then pressing 3, or by texting PRIDE to 988. Okay, well, next up, let's switch to a few healthcare stories. This is from MedPage Today. Lack of affordability tops older Americans' list of healthcare worries. A new wave of research highlights the reach of these anxieties. When the University of Michigan's National Poll on Healthy Aging asked people 50 and older about 26 health-related issues, their top three areas of concern had to do with cost, of medical care in general, of long-term care, and of prescription drugs. More than half of the 3,300 people surveyed in February and March reported being very concerned about these issues. In fact, five of the top 10 issues identified as very concerning were cost-related. Beyond the top three, people cited the cost of health insurance and Medicare, 52% of people, and the cost of dental care, 45% of people. Financial scams and fraud came in fourth place, where 53% were very concerned. Of much less concern were issues that received considerable attention, including social isolation, obesity, and age discrimination. Older adults have good reason to worry. 1 in 10 seniors, or about 6 million people, have incomes below the federal poverty level. About 1 in 4 rely exclusively on Social Security payments, which average about $1,900 a month per person. This is especially worrisome because older adults are more prone to illness and disability than younger adults, resulting in a greater need for care and higher expenses. In 2022, seniors on Medicare spent $7,000 on medical services, compared to $4,900 for people without Medicare. Not included in this figure is the cost of assisted living or long-term care stays in nursing homes, which Medicare also doesn't cover. According to Genworth's latest survey, the median annual cost of a semi-private room in a nursing home was $104,000 in 2023, while assisted living came to $64,200. And the unfortunate truth, there's very little, if any, help available for seniors who aren't poor but have modest financial resources. While the need for new dental, vision, and long-term care benefits for older adults is widely acknowledged, the question is always how to pay for it. This will become an even bigger issue in the coming years because of the burgeoning age population. There is some relief on the horizon, however. Assistance with Medicare drug costs is available through the 2022 Inflation Reduction Act, although many older adults don't realize it yet. The act allows Medicare to negotiate the price of prescription drugs for the first time. This year, out-of-pocket costs for medications will also be limited to a maximum of $3,800 for most beneficiaries. Next year, a $2,000 cap on out-of-pocket drug costs will take effect. So, we still have a lot of holes even in Medicare. We really need a comprehensive, everyone in, nobody out, health care for all.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming. Powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, next up, a teeny bit of good news coming out of pandemic healthcare years. This from the AMA. Physician burnout rate drops below 50% for first time in 4 years. Physician burnout has been a long-standing issue in the medical community. After skyrocketing to a record high 63% in 2021, exclusive survey data from the AMA show doctor burnout has fallen below 50% for the first time since 2020. For 2023, 48.2% of physicians reported experiencing at least one symptom of burnout, down from 53% in 2022. While the data from the AMA's National Physician Comparison Report includes signs that physician burnout has fallen since its peak in late 2021, the extent of the problem remains a startling reality that demands ongoing attention, especially among those who are at highest risk. Between 2022 and 2023, physicians' job satisfaction rose from 68% to 72%. Physicians continue to experience job stress, but there has been some positive movement on this key performance indicator. In 2023, 51% expressed feeling a great deal of stress because of their job, down from 56% in 2022. A source of that stress? More than one quarter of respondents said they did not have enough physicians and support staff. There was an ongoing need for more nurses, medical assistants, or documentation assistance to reduce physician workload. In addition, 13% of respondents said that too many administrative tasks were to blame for job stress. The lack of support staff, time, and payment for administrative work also increased physicians' job stress. Feeling valued is a striking mitigator of burnout. It also contributes to physicians' intent to leave their current role within 2 years. In 2023, 50% of physicians expressed feeling valued by their organization to a great extent or moderately, up from 46% in 2022. Meanwhile, 16% did not feel valued at all by the organization, which is a drop from 18%. This is a key finding for many health systems concerned about retention. So this is a healthcare delivery problem as well as an individual, huge personal problem for physicians. And of course, burnout physicians don't provide as good healthcare, unfortunately, in many cases. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. And my personal guarantee to you is if you listen to this show for 1 year, you will know more about public health than 98% of the population. And should that turn out to not be the case, I will gladly triple your money back. Okay, well, next up we have an interesting story that offers an alternative to some of the kind of high-tech, pricey healthcare that we have in the U.S. This from Stat News. The U.S. is losing control of hypertension. China's village doctors have lessons. The U.S. has slid backward on control of high blood pressure despite ready access to medicines and other tools to moderate its risk. Dan Jones, former president of the American Heart Association, thinks the nation can learn from China. Researchers there recently detailed the success of community health workers, well-trained people, but not MDs, helping thousands of people living with high blood pressure in rural regions. People received a combination of blood pressure monitoring, medication adjustments, and health coaching from these non-clinicians, saw their blood pressure readings go down significantly during the study's 4 years, a testament to the impact of people known as village doctors who went beyond usual care in the healthcare system. Why can't we do that here? Jones poses a question in light of hypertension's critical role in heart attacks, strokes, heart failure, and sudden cardiac arrest. Despite safer, cheaper, more effective, and more tolerable medications, it is quite evident that efforts to control blood pressure and reduce risk for cardiovascular disease are inadequate, he wrote in an editorial appearing with the study. Our efforts are failing patients. Where does the problem of poor blood pressure control start? There are a lot of challenges, but certainly a major one is clinical apathy. You know, clinicians are just simply not paying enough attention to controlling blood pressure. There's certainly patient apathy as well. Why is prevention so hard in the U.S.? We're just not built to deal with prevention. We like quick results. We like high tech, and as a culture, we're not very interested in simple things and things that take a long time to show results. We have a healthcare system built on rewarding innovation and end of disease in the treatment in cardiovascular disease. So if you have a new catheter for putting into coronary arteries or a new drug that either affects lipid levels or coagulation, there's a lot of interest in it. So there's a lot of money in it. But if you're talking about treating high blood pressure, there's just not a lot of interest in healthcare systems and not enough interest among physicians and other healthcare providers. High blood pressure is the silent killer. Is that what also makes it hard? It's the fact that the risk factors for both elevated cholesterol and blood pressure are not associated with symptoms. So you find it difficult to get people to do the lifestyle things and continuous use of medication to manage those problems. In today's healthcare world, physicians have less and less time to deal with the patient and more likely to focus on the complaint at hand rather than the long view of trying to help this person live a longer and healthier life. What's the history of this model in China, both in healthcare delivery and outcomes? From the mid-1980s until now in China, their life expectancy has gone from 10 to 15 years lower than the U.S. to, in parts, maybe even a little better than the U.S., and they do it with much less investment in healthcare, but with smarter investment. I was fascinated in the mid-1980s with the concept of the village doctor, focused primarily on infectious disease then, with a big focus on tuberculosis and on immunization for preventable diseases. They would take a minimally trained person and make them responsible for 300 people at a time when I first began looking at the village doctor model. As the study authors noted, the model that they use can be replicated in other low-resource countries, and I've made the point that the model would be useful in high-resource countries as well. How did that work there? The early attempts at using someone other than a physician and something other than coming to an acute care center for a visit at first had community health workers measure blood pressure and tell the patients that their blood pressure was not controlled. Well, you need to go to your doctor and get something done. These models made very little difference. what was missing in China and in a U.S. trial. Beginning about 10 years ago, researcher Ron Victor, now deceased, began doing his kind of thing among African-American men in the U.S., using barbershops as a place to engage the community and begin measuring blood pressure there and educating patients about their blood pressure. In the first couple of studies, he reported very little difference in blood pressure control. And then he used the same model in barbershops, but added to it pharmacists specially trained in blood pressure management. It was a physician-developed protocol, but the pharmacist had the authority to change the dose of medications. That was the secret, not only understanding what the blood pressure was, but immediately responding to it. Is that being applied elsewhere in the U.S.? We replicated it using telemedicine with totally remote interactions, using nurse practitioners instead of pharmacists. The key is to have a protocol that can be followed. We've been doing this for years in our blood pressure research. In my practice at the University of Mississippi Medical Center, I would recruit patients to participate in clinical trials, testing new drugs or some lifestyle therapy. I would have nurses who were two-year community college graduates who had RNs at the interface with the patient. Using the protocol that I developed, they would measure blood pressure and then they would make decisions per protocol. Blood pressure control rates were controlled so much better in that model than waiting for the patient to see me at the next three-month visit and go ahead and get the change made. Does this idea get pushed back from physicians? Part of the problem in the U.S. is going to be scope of practice. I don't want to be too harsh to my own profession, but the physician community has been very successful in limiting scope of practice for other practitioners. This is part of the problem that has to be addressed in our healthcare delivery structure, to find a way to accept a wider scope of practice for pharmacists, nurse practitioners, nurses, and perhaps even community health workers in applying a protocol developed by physicians or someone else knowledgeable enough to develop a protocol. How has this approach gone over with your patients? Acceptance has been good. Patients actually like the ability to talk to somebody at a level other than a physician. They like somebody they can go to for questions. And the model that we used in one of our studies in Mississippi was totally telehealth. The patients were very responsive to giving them an iPad to report their blood pressure, and then the nurse practitioner getting back to them later in the day with a note that says, "You're doing well, keep it up," or "We need to work on sodium restriction," or "We need to increase the dose of your calcium channel antagonist." So the community health worker approach has been around for many, many decades around the world. It's just that we have a very high-tech healthcare system that, like they said in the article, they actually restrict and limit to actually higher levels of skill when actually you can move some of that down and do it much more cheaply and inexpensively and actually less intimidating to patients. You know, when they have time to actually talk to somebody and ask questions, that is a good thing for the patient encounter. So may we improve our healthcare system by actually treating people and not just a series of conditions.
And now for a word from our lack of sponsors. PR Medica and Merciless Health are rated in the top 100 in clinical excellence in some category that hopefully covers the healthcare you might be able to access. Warning, such excellence may be severely limited by being delivered in the least effective and most expensive sick care system among the so-called advanced economies. While you may be privileged enough or lucky enough to get access to excellent care, your community overall is poorly served. Any such clinical excellence is best taken with a double dose of advocacy for universal health care. This program is not sponsored by PR Medica or Merciless Health. PR Medica and Merciless Health are unwholly owned subsidiaries of Tourette's Industries, ensuring that you will swear by them, whether you like it or not. And now, back to your irregular programming.
Okay, well, next up, we're going to hone in on sleep issues, but this time with a younger population where it can be much more complicated in that population of young children, age 1 to 6. This from Medical Express. Bedtime battles. 1 in 4 parents say their child can't go to sleep because they're worried or anxious. Many bedtime battles stem from children's after-dark worries, suggests a new national poll. And while most families have bedtime rituals to help their little ones ease into nighttime, many rely on strategies that may increase sleep challenges long-term, according to a University of Michigan Mott Children's National Poll on Children's Health. Overall, 1 in 4 parents describe getting their young child to bed as difficult. And these parents are less likely to have bedtime routines, more likely to leave on a video or TV show, and more likely to stay with their child until they're asleep. Our report reinforces the common struggle of getting young children to sleep. When this transition to bedtime becomes a nightly conflict, some parents may fall into habits that work in the moment, but could set them up for more sleep issues down the road, said the Mott Poll co-director Sarah Clark. Establishing a consistent bedtime routine is crucial. When children don't get enough rest, it can impact their physical development, emotional regulation, and behavior. Nearly 1 in 5 parents say that they have given their kids melatonin to help with sleep, while a third stay in the room until their child completely dozes off, according to the nationally representative poll that includes responses from 781 parents of children ages 1 to 6 surveyed in February. Parents share common reasons behind bedtime struggles, with nearly a quarter saying their child's sleep is often or occasionally delayed due to being worried or anxious. A particular challenge, parents say, is when children don't stay asleep. More than a third of parents say their child wakes up upset or crying, with more than 40% saying their child moves to their parents' bed, and about 30% saying children insist that their parents sleep in their room. Many young children go through stages when they become scared of the dark or worry that something bad might happen, causing them to delay bedtime or become distressed by parents leaving their room. Bad dreams or being awakened in the middle of the night can also disrupt sleep. Although this is a normal part of the child's development, it can be frustrating when parents already feel tired themselves at the end of the day. Parents should find a balance between offering reassurance and comfort while maintaining some boundaries that help ensure everyone, both kids and adults, get adequate sleep. Most parents polled report having a bedtime routine for their children, often including brushing teeth, reading bedtime stories, and/or bathing. Less than half also say their child has a drink of water or snack, turns off devices, prays, and talks about their day. Often bedtime habits include holding a blanket or stuffed animal, or sucking a pacifier or fingers. Not only does having a consistent bedtime routine help make the nighttime transition smoother, Clark says, it also provides one-on-one time, allowing the child to get their parents' full attention. A predictable bedtime routine provides a sense of security and comfort and signals to the child it's time to slow down. Knowing what to expect next can reduce anxiety and help children feel safe and relaxed. Having this dedicated time with parents also promotes bonding and emotional connection, creating positive associations with bedtime. Nearly two-thirds of parents also said children staying up to play was a major factor in delaying sleep, highlighting the need to wind down at least an hour before bed. Promote an environment conducive to sleep. A little less than half of parents polled say their child sleeps in their own bedroom, while less than a quarter share a bedroom with siblings or their parents. One in ten kids spend part of the night in their own bedroom and part of the night with parents. More than two-fifths of parents polled said noise in other rooms interfere with their child's sleep. When possible, children should have their own bed in a room that is quiet, without a lot of noise from other family members. Many parents polled also use a nightlight or crack the bedroom door so the child isn't in complete darkness, but parents should make sure the light does not shine directly in the child's face. Talk to a doctor before using aids like melatonin. Although melatonin is a natural hormone that regulates sleep-wake cycles and may be fine to use occasionally, parents shouldn't rely on it as a primary sleep aid, Clark said. Parents who are considering giving melatonin to their young child should consult with their pediatrician to discuss options and rule out other causes of sleep problems first. If using melatonin, parents should also start with the lowest dose possible. In addition, it's important to keep electronics such as tablets or televisions out of the children's bedroom, as a blue light emitted by many of these screens interferes with the natural production of melatonin. Offer comfort, but enforce boundaries. Parents can help ease little ones' anxiety by allowing extra time to let them talk about their day, which might draw out specific worries and give parents a chance to provide compassion and reassurance. Rather than remaining in the room, parents can also offer to check on the child every few minutes, which acknowledges the child's fears and offers a reassuring presence, but still maintains a calm sleep environment and promotes sleep independence. Families can incorporate comforting rituals to help transform nighttime fears into a calming experience, Clark said. Have a consistent approach when children wake up in the night. Some children are prone to vivid dreams or nightmares and may have difficulty getting back to sleep. Parents should decide on their approach to the situation and stick with it, Clark says, whether it's taking the child back to bed or allowing them to stay in the parents' room. Being consistent in carrying out that approach will help the child adjust and be more likely to return to sleep. Yep, well, if you have young children, hopefully you can establish patterns that will pay off with a lifetime of healthy sleep. Okay, and our last feature, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increase enrichment, available online just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give that link again at the end of the list. I have 24 bonus articles this week. First up, the health impacts of escalating megafires are everyone's problem. So, of course, that's everyone's problem. Who breathes air? A good overview of this escalating public health risk. Bonus article 2, athletes face significant health risks from air pollution. So this is something you might not think that much, but people are outside breathing in deeply and more air than the average person, particularly over a long period of time, can cause both acute and chronic problems. Bonus article 3, for those who breathe smoke as a sort of a vocation, the tobacco industry fights UK generational smoking ban. So, tobacco is the single largest preventable cause of death in the world, and the UK is the first one that has queued up a smoking ban that will take place where you'll reach a certain point where a new generation actually smoking will be banned completely, illegal. So that's very, of course, cutting edge, and it, as you might expect, the tobacco industry is fighting that. Bonus article 4, study finds price is main factor in cigarette choice among Canadian smokers. So we know that tobacco is pricey both as a commodity and as a social product. It costs it causes a lot of damage. That's very costly. Particularly in Canadian smokers, in Canada, there's limitations. You have these generic looking packages with huge warnings. There's not a bunch of differentiation by brand. So, of course, price has even a bigger factor. But having cheaper cigs is definitely something that's important. And if you can do taxes, that's also a reason, particularly getting people to not start smoking when they're younger, and it's even more price sensitive. Bonus article 5, BPA exposure may impact diabetes risk even at safe doses. So this is a particularly important one when you look at studies about chemical exposures, always looking at doses and stuff. And this is checking about doses that people would very easily could be exposed to and are even considered safe by the EPA or the FDA, whoever the regulatory agency is. And of course, diabetes is a large public health problem in the U.S. So this is just one more thing pushing that along, BPA exposure. Bonus article 6, microplastics continue to be found throughout human reproductive system, including the uterus. Not a surprise. Everywhere we've looked at in the human body, we found microplastics. Bonus article 7, activists urge Louisiana to reject 2,400-acre plastics plant permits in Cancer Alley. Yep, this is one place where it's all concentrated, and it's only going to make it worse by putting a huge plastic plant there. Go activists. Bonus article 8, British Columbia's toxic coal dust invades Alberta across Rocky Mountains. This is just another good example of how the world is connected. We're not even sure that the toxic coal dust, this is from open air, not with the mine shafts. Open air mining of coal creates a lot of coal dust, and this travels hundreds, even thousands of miles, in this case in Canada, across the Rocky Mountains. Bonus article 9, high levels of bacteria in water lead to multiple beach closures across the U.S. So this is due to a number of factors. When you get heavy rains, you can have fecal matter on the ground that gets carried away from animals and such, whether it's wild animals or domestic animals, particularly like large farming operations. And also when you get large rains, you can overwhelm the flood water systems and get backing up of human sewage. Bonus article 10. Mosquitoes kill more people than any other creature, the CDC warns. So this is worldwide. That's not true in the U.S., but worldwide it is when you've got malaria and yellow fever and dengue fever. In the U.S., it's growing, but not as big of a concern. But as bonus article 11 says, mosquito season is here earlier than usual. More than a third of states have detected West Nile virus, which is a particularly nasty one since we have no treatment for it and it can be debilitating or fatal. Bonus article 12, as bird flu spreads among U.S. cattle, veterinarians find themselves in a familiar position, the front lines. So we don't normally think of veterinarians as public health workers, but they are, and certainly in the potential spread of bird flu, both within the cattle and bird population, but particularly as it may jump to human beings, veterinarians find themselves between both farmers, who are more economic beings, who are looking out to avoid economic disruption, and of course, public health authorities who are trying to protect the public health from potential pandemics. Bonus Article 13, bird flu concern prompts U.S. to award Moderna $176 million for vaccine development not reliant on eggs. So a lot of our vaccine development, we grow it in eggs. Unfortunately, if it's bird flu and the bird flu is simultaneously wiping out egg layers, that might be a chicken and egg problem there. And Moderna, with the mRNA vaccinations, also can develop them more quickly, produce them more quickly. Bonus Article 14. In just a few years, half of all states passed bans on trans health care for kids. So just a few years ago, there wasn't any of these. This has moved rapidly, even though actually trans health care for kids hasn't really changed much in recent decades. It's just the view on it has changed very much and been very politicized. Bonus Article 15. In new Alzheimer's criteria, some see progress while others fear profit-driven diagnostic creep. So this is defining basically by biomarkers that you could have present 10 or 15 years before you even have any symptoms, which of course could lead potentially to treatments that might prevent. The one that was just approved by the FDA is tens and tens of thousands of dollars a year, like much of the other ones. So from a cost-benefit analysis, not a very good option, but very profitable for pharmaceutical companies. Bonus Article 16, the failure to track data on stillbirths undermines efforts to prevent them, and the problem is only getting worse. So this is an example in public health. You know, if you're not measuring it, it still may actually be happening, and we're not following stillbirths, even though tens of thousands happen each year. And on another pediatric front, Bonus Article 17, about 20,000 fewer kids would be dead each year if U.S. was on par with Europe. So this is another with a comparison country with Europe. If we had their death rates for kids, we would lose 20,000 fewer kids each year. Bonus Article 18, ultra-processed foods could increase lupus risk for women. So this is a very interesting study. It's hard to know exactly why, but given that our ultra-processed food system is producing a lot of ill health, this is an interesting kind of canary in the coal mine that is producing lupus in women. And it could be the foods themselves. It could be the fact that they're, you know, being, you know, exposed with a lot of other, you know, plastics and packaging and that kind of stuff that are reported on much as far as the toxicity it brings to us. Bonus Article 19, accounting for large changes in gut bacteria throughout the day may fix the replicability crisis in microbiome research. So this is a really interesting area of study, is studying gut bacteria. But some researchers have found that because your gut bacteria move, you know, pretty quickly through, you know, basically what you've had one meal and as it's processed through your gut, the kind of ecology of the gut bacteria changes very quickly. So you have to really account for that if you're going to try to compare one study to another. Very complicated. But it's the opposite of our kind of pharmaceutical, give me a pill with a single compound in it to save my life. The microbiome is an ecology in and of itself. Bonus Article 20. The U.S. should prioritize compensating nuclear survivors over nuclear arsenal spending, which is at 500 times greater levels. So if we spent 1/500th of what we're spending on upgrading our nuclear arsenals, we could actually, is what we're actually compensating nuclear survivors. If we up that a little bit, as was proposed in Congress but failed, we could take care of people who are harmed by some of the actions that we take. Bonus Article 21, Brazil's new pro-agribusiness pesticide law threatens the Amazon biodiversity. So this is where, you know, the lungs of the world are the Amazon, and we don't need pesticides taking that down. Bonus Article 22, the historical evidence is mounting. Humans are responsible for the extinction of large mammals much more so than climate. So this is just an interesting story, kind of on the front of Anthropocene changes, that that human beings, even thousands of years ago, were hunting large mammals to extinction. Yes, we make a difference, sometimes not always positive. Bonus Article 23, a more positive story. Permaculture leads to found to be sustainable alternative to conventional agriculture, offering environmental protection and high agricultural yields. Woohoo! Go permaculture! And last but not least, Bonus Article 24, exercise may be the single most potent medical intervention ever known. I think that's perhaps a little hyperbolic, but they're looking at, you know, for every minute of exercise that you do, you actually get multiple minutes of life added to your life. Sounds like a good deal. You can view these and all the other stories I've reported in this episode and earlier episodes by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Just for the Health of It stands ready to help sort through some of the often complicated health and public health science, giving you good evidence-based information and cutting through a lot of the garbage out there. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real, and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive, and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-